I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Forget the court-martial courts and the judge's advocate general. Any attempt to get to the bottom of the story of the civilian contractors working as interrogators at the Abu Ghraib prison is going to require the government accounting office, a team of top-flight corporate lawyers, who knows how many congressional inquiries, a grand jury, and even then, it's highly unlikely that anyone will know who hired who to do what and who was in charge. It came out yesterday, for example, that the civilians working as interrogators at Abu Ghraib had been hired under a contract to do computer work for the Interior Department. So if you can explain what keyboard maintenance in Yellowstone Park has to do with speaking Arabic and dealing with detainees in an Iraqi prison, sign here. You're now part of the legal team. What do you think about having private contractors serving alongside soldiers on the battlefield? Are you comfortable having them do things like building barracks or serving food? What about defending oil wells or dealing with prisoners? And do you think the mess at Abu Ghraib would have been as bad if every person working there, military or civilian, was subject to the same rules and regulations? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have a number of people who will help us through this maze of military managerial oversight. We're going to start with Sam Gardner. He's a retired colonel from the Air Force who's taught at the National War College. Hello, Sam.
Hello.
You watched this growth in the contractors over a number of years. How much have things really changed in the last 15, 20 years?
Well, I would say if you sort of draw a connection line between Vietnam and where we are in Gulf II, that what you have to say has changed tremendously. Maybe not in numbers, but in what they do. In Vietnam, they were supporters, maybe builders of air bases. But we have people now doing things very close to combat tasks, dealing with explosive ordnance. We have people who are doing guard duties. And we have people who are, as you said, interrogating prisoners.
And in your mind, what's the problem when the contracting work starts to look too much like the soldiering work?
Well, my mind, the biggest problem is it's a way around involving the Congress in the decision to go to war. We hire these people for a major reason. One of the major reasons is because by doing that, the Congress didn't have to get involved in a major decision to mobilize Guard and Reserve forces. See, there's a limit. Minor authorization for Guard and Reserve can be done by the president. Major authorizations require congressional approval. So by hiring the contractors, we have eliminated what I think would have been an important investigative arm on why we went to war.
But just tell me in principle whether or not you have any difficulty with the idea, the notion that the person, you know,
sure,
working in the cafeteria is going to be a contractor, the person doing truck maintenance is going to be a
sure,
contractor. Where do you draw the line?
I don't know where the line is, but we've gone too far. There are two reasons. One of them is it hurts discipline. We've heard a story about the guards at the prison wanting to wear civilian clothes. Now, why do they want to wear civilian clothes? Because people around them are wearing civilian clothes. So you can see it interferes with discipline. That's the first reason. Second reason is there is, in the history of American warfare, time after time, when the cooks have been the second line of defense. At the Battle of the Bulge, who stopped that German attack? The cooks put on their rifles and went to the front lines. When you have contractors, you can't do that.
And can you imagine a time when the Pentagon, looking at this mess that they've got on their hands, would say, yes, we have gone too far. We have
yeah,
to go back to putting men and women in uniform.
I think that after this, we begin looking at lessons learned, the military will raise that issue. There are really two Pentagons. There is the first floor, which is the civilian Pentagon, and then there are the other floors, which are the military guys. This is primarily coming from the civilian floors. The military guys, I think, will find that as we look at the history of this, that we don't want to do this again.
Sam, stay with me for a minute. I want to bring a couple of other guests into the program. Deborah Avant is a professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University, author of an upcoming book on this very subject. She's joining us along with Dan Gutman, who's an attorney teaching at Johns Hopkins University and co-author of a book called The Shadow Government, Examining the Use of Contractors in Government. They're in the same studio in Washington. Deborah and Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Deborah, let me start with you, if I can. I mean, we know what a soldier is. Are we getting anywhere close to knowing what a contractor is?
Oh, I think contractors are doing all kinds of things, so you can't even talk about what a contractor is, aside from the form in which they're hired. And I think in this conflict, more than in others past, we're really seeing a blending of roles where, in some cases, contractors are escorting military convoys, and in other times, military personnel are escorting contractor convoys. And so there are more blending of roles than we've seen before.
And we don't know how many contractors there are. 20, says the Pentagon, sometimes 30, 40, depending on which numbers you're looking at. Debbie, have we, as Sam said, crossed a line, gone too far?
Well, I think that that's really a political judgment that people will have to make. There are certainly a number of issues that we've seen because of the degree to which we've contracted out these kinds of services. A lot of the things that haven't been paid attention to are actually the effect on how active duty personnel, soldiers in Iraq feel about operating with contractors. And one thing that we've noticed through the 90s is any time that contractors are doing basically the same kind of job that the military is doing, mm-hmm. there are tensions because military personnel have much less flexibility. They often get paid less. And I think that already in Iraq, we've seen some military personnel that are a little uncomfortable with the close cooperation with contractors and are noticing the difference between the kinds of their treatment and the treatment of contractors.
Sam, you're making that same observation, I think, as well, that it's demeaning and demoralizing for the soldiers in uniform.
Right. But, to contrast, the contractors don't always have the same kinds of rights that military personnel do. In a couple of incidents in the recent weeks, contractors have run into trouble and coalition forces have failed to come to the rescue. Even though contractors have sometimes come to military forces rescue. And so I think that the inclarity, the different sets of rules are really rearing their head in this conflict.
Dan Gutman, we talk about this as something that has evolved since the time of Vietnam, but your own work and your research says that these questions and kind of puzzling over the role of the contractors goes back to the early 60s.
Yeah, I think that that Debbie and Mr. Gardner have said some wonderful things, but I think the bigger picture is that what we're seeing here was not only predictable, it's the tail of a much bigger problem. Basically, since the dawn of the Cold War, we've had a bipartisan Republican Democratic policy to grow government through use of contractors. We've done it through a simple means, keeping a lid on the size of the civil service. So whenever we've had new work to be done, as we've had in this nation-building and transitional failed states, we hire contractors. It's predictable.
But are we talking here when you use the term contractors of Boeing and Raytheon and the large corporations that do Defense Department research, stuff like that?
Well, we're talking about, obviously, an extension, for those of us all to remember, what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, but people don't appreciate the extent to which what we're seeing in terms of the integration of the contractor workforce into the government workforce is a routine, has been a routine thing in government in Washington and all kinds of agencies now for decades. When the Environmental Protection Agency wants to write regulations, it hires contractors. When personnel clearances are done on civilians, they're done by a contractor. When a civilian files a government EEO complaint, contractors will be hired to investigate them. What we see in Iraq is remarkably visible. Department of Homeland Security has got $25 billion in grants and contracts. Who knows where they're going? Condi Rice on 9/11, and when she testified before the commission, said the problem we have with Homeland Security is that the CIA and the FBI don't talk to one another. Well, guess what? Who's doing the talking? You look at the websites of some of these contractors people probably haven't heard of, SAIC, Booz Allen, very prominent. They advertise that they work for all the intelligence functions, have on their boards or staffs former heads of the CIA, Defense Department, hundreds of intelligence people. In many respects, what we're looking at is far more visible in Iraq because of the obvious importance of it than what goes on every day. And you've got two kinds of basic problems. One is, as Sam and Debbie said, it's out of control. It's just as if money is the mother's milk of politics, but we have campaign finance for them because things are out of control. We are now in a world where at the highest levels of government, it's acknowledged we lack the official workforce to oversee the contractors, and contractors doing more and more sensitive work, and we have no rules of law
that
apply
Sam,
to contractors.
Sam Gardner, this was one of your observations, that in fact these private contractors that Dan's talking about are doing the planning, doing the thinking for the military now.
Well, and I just found out yesterday, which blows me away, General Kicklider, who is planning the post-handover defense structure for the Pentagon and the Coalition Provisional Authority, is a contractor. I mean, so we are, it has gone to
a general in whose army then? This is a former U.S. Army general.
A former U.S. Army general, now as a contractor, is working on the details of the post-handover structure in Iraq.
And I guess, Debbie, that's another part of what is both difficult and slightly demeaning for the people who are in Iraq in uniform, is that a lot of these people, like this general, are into their second career, making a whole lot more money than the grunts who are on the ground in places like Abu Ghraib.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And we don't really know. I mean, despite the fact, I think Dan is absolutely right that this is sort of a long-term trend, and this has happened in many parts of government. What's remarkable to me is how little we've actually studied this in the sense of understanding how this is going to affect the workforce. It's hard to tell right now. There's a lot of tensions sort of on the ground, but there also are a lot of people that are planning their future careers. And so in some sense, it could be a recruiting tool, although it may be, cutting in on retention as Special Forces personnel, not only in the U.S., but in the U.K., in Chile, have been separating from the force at a higher than average level since the war in Iraq, partly because some have questioned the recruiting of private security companies.
Now, Sam Gardner, there's a bright light on this right now because seven uniformed soldiers have been or are being charged for what happened at Abu Ghraib. No civilian contractors have been charged yet, though there is a criminal investigation now underway. Is it your view that the people in the Pentagon, Floor 1 and Floor 2, are squirming now simply because that light is on, or are they for the first time going, wow, we really do have problems figuring out which laws and which rules apply?
Yeah, I think they're having trouble, but I don't think they've yet begun to squirm. I think that, I think that it's going to come out about the contractors. And I think what's going to happen is not only that, but we're going to start seeing things. You know, the CIA now operates clandestine people under contract. Some of them were killed in Afghanistan. So I think just our discussion today is probably part of the process where this whole thing is going to get laid out, and we're going to have to look for some ways to change for the future.
Sam, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Sure.
Sam Gardner is a retired Air Force colonel, taught military strategy and operations at the Army War College. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join our conversation as we talk about the contractors in Iraq, the legal oversights, the rules that govern them, the complicated and messy links in the chain of command. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, and we're talking about those contractors in Iraq now in the spotlight because of the images from Abu Ghraib and the fact that men and women in uniform are being marked for what happened there, and the civilian contractors are only now just starting to creep into the news, names of companies that most of us had never heard of before, and we'll probably be hearing a lot more about CACI and Titan and SOS and DynCorp and Vanel and Intercon Security. 1-800-423-TALK to join us. Let's take our first call from Nags Head, North Carolina. George is with us. Hi, George.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think what bothers me the most is the congressional abdication of its authority, both to control the purse strings and to monitor and maintain oversight on what's going on.
You think that was a passive or an active abdication on Congress's part? I mean, do you think that they even were paying attention, George?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, it goes back to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and even further than that. I mean, they've gotten out of the declaration of war business, and this is just a continuation of that.
So is it about the decision to go to war, or is it about paying the costs of war?
Well, I think it's both, and I think the fact that we really have one party in control of both the White House and the Congress exacerbates that problem. The opposition party, which might be responsible for conducting inquiries into what the administration should be doing, really has no ability to do that when the majority party is also in control of the White House.
George, let me turn to Debbie Avon. She's a professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University. And Debbie, the whole idea of having private contractors, however far back you go to mark that, wasn't that always intended principally to be a money-saving exercise?
In some ways it was, although I think many of the arguments for contracting out, at least in the last 15 years, have been made on the basis of stretching the personnel force that the military has rather than cost savings per se. And in fact, there's a whole set of studies on privatization that tell us that there are two conditions that have to be met in order to save money. One is there has to be competition, and two is that the contractor has to be able to do things flexibly, in other words, different from how the government would otherwise do it. And when you're talking about military operations, those two conditions are frequently not met because they're, you know, serious, sensitive tasks that need to be done, and the military may be less likely to either go to competition or to allow the contractor to do things flexibly. And so cost efficiency is not something that generally is enhanced by contracting out military services.
But it was meant to be, wasn't it?
Well, can I?
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, 2 points. One, George is right, but not completely right. First of all, it is a failure of Congress, but it isn't a one party. This goes back 50 years when both parties pretended we'd grow government by contracting out without regard to cost. This is a dirty little secret. When I oversaw this, I had the privilege to work with Senator David Pryor in the 80s. You were required to contract without any cost studies because you couldn't hire more civil servants. The first thing Bill Clinton came in when he said he's going to reinvent government was say, I'm going to cut 300,000 civil servants without regard to whether the contractors be cheaper or could be overseen. The basic reality, as I see it, is that the decision to set our government on a course to grow by contracting, bipartisan 50 years ago, wasn't made on cost, but it was made by best and brightest reformers, one of the most eminent of whom was the first dean of the Kennedy School up at Harvard, Don Price, who wrote a book, 1965, saying, this is terrific. Americans can't stand big government. We are afraid of totalitarian takeover. We want to grow our government to do things, and the way we'll do it is partner with the private sector for three basic reasons, and cost was not really a prominent one. One was expert resources, industry. Two was to countervail against the dead hand, the big bureaucracy. Nobody likes big government. And three, contractors add political clout to a program. NASA was created in 1958 to go to the moon, and that was decided to be a contract-driven agency, mostly contractors, so they'd have political support. So efficiency, you know, it's an irony that people talk about efficiency because nobody really thinks that's the real driver in this. There are no measures. Nobody steps back. Nobody's going to go into Iraq and say, well, gee, who was more efficient? We don't have the dollars to look at efficiency. Efficiency is really a red herring in this debate.
But we should be making a distinction here, should we not, Dan, between a company that is contracted by NASA to come up with a certain kind of bolts for a space shot to the kind of contractors who are, you know, being hired to do interrogation at a prison in a war zone?
Well, yes and no. Of course, I'm not talking about contracting for papers and pencils and things that are commercially available, but in the government today, we've got the wholesale use of contractors on three bases. One, we turn over entire projects. We say, Boeing, you build the space shuttle. And when it explodes, we had the Linda Hamm from the space shuttle saying, I didn't know anything about the foam. Only Boeing knew about it. We didn't have the expertise. So one is we turn over gigantic projects. Homeland Security, people don't realize the Coast Guard of the future has been turned over for building to Lockheed. The General Accounting Office a month or two ago said we don't have people in the Coast Guard capable of overseeing it. So we're turning over monster projects. Two is we're hiring contractors as bodies. That's the CACI and interrogator story. We're saying we don't have people in the government. We're not hiring a contractor to build something. We just need extra bodies. But that's not a news story. Any agency on the mall in Washington, you walk in, you'll find contractors right. integrated with the workforce. So, yeah, we're not talking about it's terrific that the government goes out and buys computers from HP or Dell or laundry services or routine commercial goods. But we're talking about the lock, stock, and barrel wholesaling of government without adequate oversight.
I should
agency
mention,
after agency.
I should mention for our listeners that we spent a fair amount of time on the phone yesterday speaking to some of the contracting firms that we had named. All of them declined to join us on the program today. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Providence, Rhode Island, Timothy's with us. Hi, Timothy.
Hi. Thank you for addressing this topic. My concern is, aren't these really mercenaries? Aren't we subverting the normal chain of command that is incorporated in the democratic process? And doesn't this absolve everybody from the ground up of responsibility, morality?
What's your definition, Timothy, just out of curiosity, of a mercenary? Because I've heard that term itself sort of debated.
Well, I think it's I think the dictionaries define it as anybody who is hired wage war by government.
And the funny thing is, Debbie Avant, that some of the soldiers, some of the contractors are hired to do just that, and some of them aren't, and some of them do it part of the time and other duties the rest of the time. So it is very hard to fix on a definition, isn't it?
It is very difficult. In fact, if you look historically at the forms that have been called mercenary, they've included everything from, you know, hiring troops from another government to come and fight, say, for the British in the American Revolution, or hiring individual hired guns, as happened often in Africa in the 1960s. I think mercenary is a term that generally refers to a military practice that we think is illegitimate. I mean, if you look at our active duty soldiers, a lot of them come into the force for the pay, for the experience, for the educational benefits. I mean, they're patriotic too, but so are some of the contractors. So I think that the distinction is not quite so sharp as the caller suggested, although the fact that we feel a little bit uncomfortable with the role that contractors are playing in Iraq suggests that they may be bridging on illegitimacy, at which point I think they, you know, we would call them mercenaries because mm-hmm. they don't fit our ideals of the way we should be fighting the war.
Dan Gutman, I wonder if I can get you to speak just briefly to the other part of Timothy's question, and that is responsibility. I mean, are there clear-cut rules, laws on
No.
the books which govern their behavior?
Well, we got two kinds of rules. This is the basic problem. Is, as I said, we Republican and Democrat are pretending that officials and soldiers are in control. So we have, over our history, built up a whole body of laws to protect us against big government. The most important, obviously, is the Constitution. The Bill of Rights, people forget, prohibits the government from infringing on your speech, but it doesn't prohibit a private company from doing so. Similarly, we've got 200 years of other laws: Freedom of Information Act, Conflict of Interest, pay caps, and in the military, the Code of Military Justice, which apply to officials but not contractors. That's fine if officials are in control of contractors. If we could assume that all the contractors out there were under the control of officials and not doing this sensitive government work, then things might be okay, but that's not the reality. And so we have no rules that we apply to officials to apply to contractors. Instead, we regulate them under the kind of contract law that you have in commercial dealings. You're going out and buying a house or a car, and those don't contemplate these situations. And the real irony here is that what's being made clear by the press reports is that even those rules are being broken, so that a lot of the contracts that are awarded illegally, flat out in violation of basic contract law. So you've got a double problem. One of the rule of law that we apply to protect us against people doing sensitive government work doesn't apply to contractors. Two, the rules that we have to apply to contractors are being violated right and left, according to the public reports.
And Debbie, what do you make of this juggling of the laws that are on the books? I see people debating a 1994 for law about torture and questions about whether or not, you know, abuse at Abu Ghraib qualifies as a war crime, and how does this Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act fit in here? Does anybody know the answers to those questions?
No, and I think, you know, part of the issue is, you know, as you mentioned in your remarks earlier, military personnel are already being prosecuted, and contractors, you know, at least there's an investigation begun now, but, you know, despite the fact that a contractor was one of the two people that was highlighted in the Taguba report as being, you know, one of the ringleaders for the particular problematic situation at Abu Ghraib, there have not been any actions taken against the civilian contractors. And I think the legal inclarities are a big part of that. And, you know, the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, which we call MEJA for short, is something that only applies to Department of Defense employees, as it's now written.
Not the CIA, for example.
So this Department of Interior administration of this contract may actually complicate efforts to hold these people criminally accountable. Now, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't, you know, tell you how that's going to work out. But I think even lawyers would admit that we're not sure how it's going to work out. And that's part of the problem. Code of Military Justice is relatively clear, and I think that the inclarities in the law that applies to contractors is a big issue.
Dan, you're a lawyer. Do you want to add to that?
Yeah, punctuate. Debbie makes a nice point about this arcane, newly discovered 2000 law, whether it applies to an Interior Department point, but the level, going back to Sam's point, of the unpreparedness of our legal geniuses in the government for this predictable problem. In March, on March 23rd, the Defense Department issued a proposed rule to apply to contractors certain laws, make them require abide by certain laws, and one of which was the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The thing that was issued by the Department of Defense said that code will apply, quote, where applicable. Well, I turned over my webpage to find maybe some explanation so that if you're a contractor, a contractor employee, you'd know what the heck where applicable meant. And I called a wonderful gentleman in the Pentagon who's responsible, and he chuckled and said, well, you know, we're really not sure. There's some debate, and there is some debate about whether it applies only when Congress declares a war or not. But the basic point is, here we are. This was not like weapons of mass destruction, something beyond our ability to analyze. We knew this problem was coming, and at this late date, we can't even say whether there's a lawful basis to require contractors to abide by the Uniform Code of Military Justice if we give them notice and make them agree to it.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. What do you think, Connection listeners? If you are a contractor, are you responsible? Or is the company that hired you in the United States and sent you to Iraq responsible? And where does the military fit in if there are accusations about behavior such as what we've seen in Abu Ghraib? Are there different laws that fit? Then let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. David's joining us on the line. Dave, thanks for calling.
My pleasure. I wanted to ask, first of all, that the guest that you have, be careful to make a distinction about contractors that support the civilian aspects of the government and contractors that support the DOD. I happen to support the Environmental Protection Agency, and I wanted to correct a couple of statements that were made earlier. First of all, contractors absolutely do not make policy decisions. They may not make policy decisions. They can provide all kinds of expertise. They can write white papers. They can help with the editing of documents. They do not make policy decisions. And the second thing is, a statement was made that there's almost no kind of controls or laws or any kind of oversight on how contractors behave. I don't know about pardon me about how that fits in with DOD contractors, but on the civilian sector, I'm sorry, on the civilian sector, there are definitely a lot of rules, pages and pages and volumes that make it very clear about how civilian contractors that support the civilian aspects of the government may behave.
I would think, Dave, in your shoes, that you would think yourself in a completely different class from some of the civilian contractors who we've been reading about and reporting about in Iraq, raising all these questions about their involvement with the military, that those kinds of rules are a whole lot different from the type that you would live under.
I would agree entirely. I am a veteran. I was in special forces, and so I'm fairly familiar with a lot of what goes on in the military as well. And I would agree with that. I think that the rules and the expected behaviors and the oversight, et cetera, are fairly different, and the expectations.
Can I ask you as a veteran, though, Dave, whether or not you think that the whole contractor thing in Iraq is going to cause serious problems for everybody's idea of the role of those people, particularly in battlefield situations?
I think that when contractors are used in what we could, for lack of a better term, describe as battlefield conditions, not in terms of facility support, but in terms of actual, well, what happened in Abu Ghraib and in contractors holding weapons to escort military groups, that's where we go too far.
And Debbie Avant, just to take the point that Dave's making at the tail end there about the kinds of decisions that private contractors would have to make on the battlefield if they're accompanying a convoy, they don't get to, you know, radio into head office and say, I'm under fire, what do I do? They're hired, actually, to react, to make, I mean, call it a policy decision, call it a battlefield reaction, but they're hired to make those kinds of decisions themselves. That alone is a big difference, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's interesting that the caller mentions is the difference between contracting in a battlefield situation. And I might also suggest that it's hard to anticipate ahead of time what kinds of tasks will be sensitive in a battlefield situation. You might not think that truck driving would be a sensitive task, and yet if it's truck driving through an area that's beset by an insurgency, mm-hmm. it might in fact be. And that's one of the difficulties that the military has had for a long time. And in fact, that was the logic behind having so many tasks incorporated within the military, having modern militaries grow such large logistics capacities, was the fact that in the midst of a war, it's even mundane tasks become tasks that are, first of all, crucial. You have to have the fuel in order to get your trucks to run, and so the truck driver may be very important. And second of all, they run great risks, and having military expertise can be important in mitigating some of that risk. And so I think the issue of contractors on the battlefield does have some special qualities to it that probably increase the sensitivity and importance of the general problems that we see in contracting.
And it raises some serious legal questions, which this government will be addressing in the months ahead. We have certainly only just started to figure out how that's going to be untangled at the same time as the courts-martial are underway. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about contractors and where they, if they fit. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. KP duty is one thing. K-9 duty is something completely different. If the contractor is the one holding the leash in the prison, we're talking about the contractors this hour on the program. And we're going to take our next call from Stowe, Massachusetts. Don is with us. Hi, Don.
Good morning. My point, I guess, I don't know whether it's correctly addressed to your analyst there today, but I think that we've been discussing the legal and military and logistical aspects of all of this. We're missing the elephant in the room, and that's the political aspect, because the magnification of the numbers of people over there have basically allowed President Bush to stand up on national television addresses and make the statement that we have 138,000 troops on the ground. And I think that for most people who don't have the luxury of listening to this kind of analysis, it completely obfuscates what's really going on there. How many people do we have? What is our total human commitment? And I think they're trying to draw a unnecessary distinction between this.
It's an interesting question, Don, because I'm kind of torn in my own mind about whether or not people listening would think, wow, the difference between 130,000 and 150,000 or 170,000 would change my attitude about what's happening in Iraq. But the point that you're making is that you see it as an attempt to keep the numbers as low as possible?
Yes, in an attempt to base it. Do we know that it's only 20,000? I mean, has anyone actually come out with an assessment of the actual numbers of truck drivers all the way up to some of these more esoteric contractors? I'd be interested to know what the total number is, and perhaps some of the American public might be willing to. It's a
subterfuge.
Dan, go ahead.
I can take. Well, first, I think the caller is absolutely right that the underlying problem, and again, in my perspective, it's not simply Iraq, is we're pretending we're keeping the size of government down by growing it through this, what I call the shadow government. And obviously, that's got profound political ramifications. So one of my friends is a reporter on this, says $87 billion for Iraq, but not a penny more for a government official or a soldier to oversee that stuff. But on the numbers, we have no clue. The absence of data, basic data on contractors, is pretty remarkable. Highest officials in the Pentagon in 2002, a year before the Iraq war began, the Army Secretary, Secretary White, wrote a memo to the three undersecretaries under Rumsfeld saying, we are growing our Army through contractors. This is not a Bush 1, Bush 2. It's been going on. We don't have, quote, visibility. We don't know the labor costs, the numbers, or who they work for. At the time, the best estimates of the numbers of people doing service contract work, that is people work as opposed to building planes, the best the Army could come up with was 100,000 to 600,000. At the time, in 2002, the Secretary of the Army said, we need to collect data to find out how many contractor employees we're employing. That effort has not gotten underway. It's been caught up in red tape and other bureaucratic delay. So all we're seeing in what we see now is guesses, because as you're saying at the early part of the program, these contracts are coming from all over the place, from the Department of Interior, from other agencies. So nobody's sitting there counting a number of people. People can just put out requests, give us some estimate, but that's just wild estimates today because we don't have basic data.
Well, Debbie,
if I could just add something. I think the caller is absolutely right. And in fact, the subtitle of my book is Private Security and Political Change. And I think it's not just a matter of the numbers that we don't know, but contractors are mobilized through different processes. And these processes have different roles, a much lesser role for Congress. They have different levels of transparency, less transparency. And in general, I think allow for foreign policy that doesn't have the same level of public support that would be demanded if we were using our military forces only.
1-800-423-8255. Don, thanks for, or next to Don, rather, who's calling in from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Don.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Great. I'm going to make a quick point as well, and it relates to the command and control structure. The absence of a uniform, and it's in the history there have been great lessons of mercenaries involved in war fighting for a client. We have many, many mercenaries, is my view of the contractors there today, fighting for us. And they're outside of the command and control structure, and that historically is different than many, many, many of the war situations that we have seen through time. It makes the command and control structure unable to assert its authority because of the lack of the uniform. There is no clear line. There is no clear understanding. And
Is that the difference, Don, though, if those contractors that you're describing are put in uniform? Does that make it a little bit easier to understand how the chain of command works?
It does, and I use the Vietnam example. There were guys I served with who talked about the spooks, who were the CIA guys in the field, who were out there essentially in command situations or supporting a commander who was a green lieutenant from OCS. And the truth is that command structure was very clear because those were uniformed colleagues. There was a clear command relationship through an embassy, and the uniform was there. Now, they weren't really part of the military, but they were attached and very clearly adjunct and related to what the guys in the field were doing. I want to go further and just make the example of the difference between what we're doing today and what mercenaries in the past did, because the mercenaries wore the uniform of the day, the Hessians that supported the British in the Revolutionary War. They go back through history and the examples time and again, and it does point to one more flaw in this theory about the Bush approach to war, and that is we effectively are fighting a war that our society is not willing to take the risk for. We're not willing to put our troops on the line, and the draft is gone, and we have to buy services at a much higher cost. And that is market-driven. There's no effort to save money here. This is not about controlling money. It's about spending money because we don't have the political will as a nation to commit to this ourselves.
And Dan Gutman, this becomes, Don, thanks for that observation. It becomes a question then of morality. If you can't, you know, get people to support a cause, then you can probably get people to support it by paying them to participate in it. I don't want to say, for example, that we've made a shift from, you know, historical wars to something completely different in Iraq. But I think Don's got his finger on something, doesn't he?
No, I think both of your last callers, this is really, and I think Debbie's, this is a political issue. It's not a technical issue. It's, does the country want to go to war with its government and its soldiers, or do we want to do things in some other way that we don't have rules for? But your point is, it's really an interesting one about political will and what are the underlying questions.
Debbie, a thought from you?
You know, I obviously that's the tack that I would take in the analysis. And I think that, you know, the big question for the country is really, you know, whether this is a wise decision. One other issue that callers might not be aware of is, you know, we're talking about these contractors as if they are retired military and police personnel from the United States. But the growth in demand in Iraq has been so great that many of these companies are recruiting internationally. And so we're really talking about an international private force. And they're not only working for the U.S. Army or the Coalition Provisional Authority, they're working for oil companies, they're working for NGOs. And so the contracting authority has not only diffused in the sense that we're contracting for the delivery of services rather than having soldiers, but we also are diffusing authority over who gets to contract for security. And in fact, you know, some of the CPA's efforts to get their hands around the security situation in Iraq have required contractors like Bechtel, construction workers, to have security in their contract so as to not waste American dollars by, you know, building something that then gets taken apart by the insurgents. But what that's really doing is, you know, causing the private sector to be responsible for security rather than the public sector, which is a big change from the sort of modern state system that we're all used to.
Yeah, a coda on Debbie's point. One is that one of the big differences in the rules of law that apply to officials and contractors is the conflict of interest system mm-hmm. that we've applied for hundreds of years to officials doesn't apply to contractors. And that may be fine if we don't use them in sensitive work. And when we do, we have people who oversee them. But as we see in the daily reports, the folks going to work for these some contractors, nobody's doing background checks. And Debbie's making the bigger point, the contractors themselves, who knows who else they may be working for.
And, so and if Bechtel irony, subcontracts to a company which hires protection and those soldiers riding with the oil trucks are Turkish or Colombian or Chilean, does that mean that they are almost completely outside any reach of any American or American-imposed law in this situation?
Well, and who knows what the way the problem actually presents itself, and Debbie, I'm sure, will comment, is a much more profound problem. The problem is we have, because we've contracted out for so many years in the military, we are losing the key capability in the military and the civilian oversight official workforce to even know how a lot of this high-tech equipment is being operated, because it's being from day one built, designed, maintained, and operated by contractors. So you've got those people on contract who have the keys to all this technology. They leave. They go to work for someone else. What do we do?
And
I mean, this is a
wisdom.
Profound question.
Yeah, okay. Let's get
and just to
Debbie,
get back
can you hang
to
on
the,
for half a sec? I want to just try and squeak in one more call. This one from Columbia, South Carolina. Paul's with us now. Hi, Paul.
Hi. That was exactly my point that somebody, I think, had just started to make, which was the money involved. You're paying a soldier who's going to be on the front line. These contractors are on the front line only in the sense that they're right behind the guy with the body armor and the gun whose job it is to shoot. And that guy is getting paid less than those people.
Hey, some of those people are wearing the body armor and carrying the guns as well, some of those contractors, Paul.
Some of them are. But, you know, it's not like there's no historical background for this.
Right.
It's called the East India Company. Look what the British did in India with the East Indian Company. All of this has been done before in Iraq or in the colonies that Britain had. We are reliving history. We are repeating it. We are not learning from it. We are not doing anything new.
So, Paul, if you
all we do is have high tech.
So if a kid in America wants to be a soldier, are you saying, Paul, that kid has a choice? Join the Army or find a company like Titan or CACI and go overseas that way?
No, his choice is, I ain't re-enlisting, pal, because I'm not going to get paid diddly squat to carry a gun when I can get paid more to be a security consultant.
And what happens, Debbie, when the U.S. military becomes a training ground for these legions of contractors?
Well, I think there's, to a certain extent, that's already happening. And you see people, actually, there was an interesting comment on NPR story just a little while ago where somebody was going to Iraq to get the experience so that he could start his own private security company. And there, you know, so I think that there we don't know what impact that'll have on the military. As I said earlier, it may actually spur recruitment, but inhibit retention.
Right.
And what that would mean is, of course, that the U.S. government would be spending a great amount of money to train people and then losing them to contractors that would then charge the U.S. government more to hire them back.
And if I may, I think all these callers are making wonderful points. And to put it in the bigger context, yes, the East India Company at one time had 250,000 soldiers in control of the subcontinent we now call Indian Pakistan.
Right.
And people have to remember, this is, we only are coming out of a period, brief period, our own lifetimes, where we thought there was something called the civil service and the military that was separate from contractors. Our Constitution, insofar as it deals with this, says we can hire, in essence, mercenaries. Congress can grant letters of marque and reprisal. Commission private folks to go out and sink enemy ships for bounty. That's in our Constitution. The civil service system we have is only a creation of the late 19th century. It was in the 1950s we began to contract out. So we're in a point, we may be emerging from a blip where we thought there was such a thing as an official government that was distinct and did the work of government. And we really are at a point we have to decide whether, well, let's give up that game and admit that these contractors are terrific folks. They got trained by the government. They got the best training in the world. They're out there now making higher salaries, and let's go with them. But then we got to have a rule of law that is consistent with their current responsibilities.
Debbie, quick
and
last
actually,
one
if
to
I
you.
Might add,
yeah, just
if I could add, just add something quickly on the East India Company. There was actually a much greater set of authoritative structures around the East India Company than there is over contracting in Iraq, I might submit, just because the East India Company was actually chartered by the British government, whereas many of the companies that are hiring security operators in Iraq are doing so, you know, according to their own standards. There is no charter. There is no sort of overarching authority. And so there really is a much greater diffusion of control now, I would say, even than in some of the past circumstances.
Interesting to look back. In order to look ahead, Debbie, thanks a lot for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Debbie Avant is a professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University. And Dan Gutman, thanks a lot for your help.
Thank you.
Dan is a professor at Johns Hopkins University. Earlier in the program, we talked with the retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.